9:37 a.m., the Pentagon. 10:03 a.m., an explosion and a plane crash in Pennsylvania. According to Bush, everything was clear and obvious. But was this really the reality?
Who attacked our country? The evidence we have gathered all points to a collection of loosely affiliated terrorist organizations known as Al-Qaeda. This group and its leader, a person named Osama bin Laden.
Bob Graham, former governor of Florida, and the head of the 9/11 Fact-Finding Commission. The commission made a detailed report on the terrorist attacks in 2003. Parts of the report were published. It's known as the 28-page document. The role of Saudi Arabia and the Bush administration was a fact Bob Graham and his colleagues highlighted.
The release of the 28 pages received a variety of interpretations. There were some who said that this confirmed the Saudi link to the 9/11 hijackers. Did these 19 people, most of whom did not speak English, most of whom had never been in the United States before, most of whom were not well educated, did they carry out this sophisticated task alone, or did they have some form of support while they were in the United States? If the answer is they had some support, who provided that support?
A hidden network that spread from Riyadh to the White House. At the head of the network, there was a Saudi man named Bandar bin Sultan. He was Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the U.S. from 1983 to 2005. He was the head of the National Security Council for some time. He was also the head of the Saudi spy agency from 2012 to 2014. His influence in the Bush administration paved the way for the tragic event. September 13, 2001, 2 days after the September 11th attacks. Bandar bin Sultan, along with Bush and his team, are on the Truman balcony of the White House.
Almost 3,000 American victims and their families deserve justice. They deserve the right in a court of law to be able to present the evidence that they have gathered, which is voluminous, that will link the kingdom and other entities of Saudi Arabia to the 19 hijackers.
All the fact-finding commission was saying was Saudi Arabia was behind the 9/11 attacks. But the most obvious question is, then why did the U.S. attack Afghanistan immediately after the 2001 attacks? If the U.S. was supposed to attack somewhere, it should have been Saudi Arabia, not Afghanistan.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
On October 7, 2001, the CIA Special Forces were the first Americans who entered Afghanistan via Pakistan, and the large-scale aerial attacks followed afterwards. From New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania to Kabul, Herat, and Kandahar. The false flag 9/11 attacks were the excuse to rein in the impoverished country. Afghanistan had no role in what had happened. It's really interesting that Fox News saying, according to a survey, 92% of the youth in Afghanistan have not even heard anything about the 9/11 attacks.
So
U.S. did not set foot in Afghanistan for the first time in 2001, but it was the early 1980s. The importance of Afghanistan's oil and gas reserves in Central Asia started a new rivalry between the Soviet Union and the U.S.
Massive Soviet military forces have invaded the small, non-aligned, sovereign nation of Afghanistan. A Soviet-occupied Afghanistan to possible control over much of the world's oil supplies.
In 1979, the Soviet forces occupied Afghanistan. Carter immediately tasked the CIA with taking countermeasures. Zbigniew Przezinski, Carter's national security advisor, came up with a scheme. He decided to deploy some radical and Arab militia forces in Afghanistan.
We know of their deep belief in God, and we are confident that their struggle will succeed. That land over there is yours. You'll go back to it one day because your fight will prevail, and you'll have your homes and your mosques back again because your cause is right and God is on your side.
On the other hand, he decided to organize the domestic militia forces. Money, weapons, and extremism. It was a dangerous combination.
When the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, we had this brilliant idea that we were going to come to Pakistan and create a force of Mujahideen, equip them with Stinger missiles and everything else to go after the Soviets inside Afghanistan. And we were successful. The Soviets left Afghanistan, and then we said, great, goodbye. Leaving these trained people who were fanatical in Afghanistan and Pakistan, leaving them well armed.
Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S., sought to export the Wahhabi ideology to Afghanistan through Arab militants. One of its clear examples was bin Laden. As a Saudi national, he was linked to the powerful Saudi network.
Let's go recruit these Mujahideen, and let's great, let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam.
In the end, it was the Afghan people who fell victim to the war between the U.S. and Soviet Union. The tragic thing was extremist Wahhabism crept into Afghanistan.
Their support for the 9/11 hijackers has been to encourage Saudi Arabia to be involved in more of the same. They've continued to fund al-Qaeda. They were a significant part of the establishment of ISIS. They have supported madrasas, which teach young people hatred and intolerance, of mosques, which preach jihad to adults. All those things have happened after 9/11.
The U.S. and Saudi support for radicalism in Afghanistan did not end with extremist militias or al-Qaeda. Daesh was a new disaster that came to Afghanistan. Hundreds of dead and wounded was the result of Daesh presence in Afghanistan.
Was it that this extremism came from your schools and from your mosques?
And in part, I blame ourselves also in hindsight. Because are there things that we could have done? Probably. But at the time that this was all, that all these forces were being unleashed, you deal with them at the time.
Under such circumstances, and due to the insecurity in Afghanistan, although the U.S. had spent over $2 trillion in the country from 2001 to 2021, it failed to restore minimum peace to the country. To get a clear picture of how big the number is, think of, for example, $62 billion. It is almost equal to the U.S.'s annual budget needed to stay in Afghanistan. It is more than the entire UK military budget and more than the US Department of Homeland Security's budget. After the massive failure in Afghanistan, Trump decided to put an end to U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
Why are we there? We're 6,000 miles away. Where Taliban is here, ISIS is here, and they're fighting each other. I said, why don't you let them fight? Why are we getting in the middle of it? I said, let them fight. They're both our enemies. Let them fight. But they go in and they end up fighting both of them. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen.
With Trump's strategy, it was predictable that he would face major differences with the U.S. military commanders. The top military official regarding Afghanistan was General James Mattis.
Do you agree that we're not winning in Afghanistan?
Sir, I understand the urgency. I understand it's my responsibility. We're not winning in Afghanistan right now.
He confessed to the failure in Afghanistan and believed that the process of failure had been expedited because of Trump's measures. That's why Trump was dissatisfied with General Mattis more than anyone else. As he was a businessman, Trump's economic approach was meant to make profits in Afghanistan, or at least make up for the money spent in the country. Blackwater is a notorious name among private security contractors. Eric Prince was the director of the firm and Trump's unofficial military advisor. Prince tried to provide an answer for Trump in Afghanistan. He presented Trump with a plan to tackle the financial loss in Afghanistan. First of all, Eric Prince knew well that the U.S. Army has failed in Afghanistan.
The mighty U.S. military, the most powerful and expensive military in the history of mankind, gets defeated by largely illiterate goat herders using very simple weapons, AKs, PKs, Dishkas, and homemade explosives. Please, be honest with ourselves. Who could say that our 17 years, trillions of dollars, 2,400 U.S. dead, tens of thousands of wounded, has been a raging success? I would disagree.
Secondly, privatizing the Afghan war by Eric Prince would tremendously reduce the costs.
I've laid out this plan, this alternative, that comes in at less than 8% of what the Pentagon is spending.
Thirdly, the role of Afghanistan mineral deposits in generating revenues and making up for the war expenditure.
Look, I've got a lot of other things. I spend most of my time mining and looking for natural resources in weird places of the world. This would be a passion project. The private sector can do this. The business of America is business. It's not warfare. We've been looking for minerals, and there is an enormous mineral and energy potential in Afghanistan if you could just set security long enough. Okay, so if you have a reliable battalion in the area that can pacify an area, then you can attract the private capital to build.
So Eric Prince's alternative plan for Trump was a meaningful combination of the mines and the privatization of the Afghan war.
Now he's president. He's saying, well, they've got like $1 trillion of minerals in Afghanistan. Why don't we at least take it to pay for the war? No, that would be stealing. That would be robbing from them. Trump thinks, well, I don't like the option of leaving anymore. I don't like the option of putting in more troops. Mm-hmm. And he's, in other words, biding his time to introduce the option of, why don't we just give it to my friend Eric Prince and let him make billions of dollars off of it? That way the millions he gave us will be repaid by billions from taxpayers.
Mines and Trump were the two keywords that were meaningful in Afghanistan. Wilbur Ross was Trump's Secretary of Commerce. His interview gave a clear picture of Trump's approach toward mines in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan It hasn't gotten, I mean, the president obviously gave his big speech recently about sending more troops there. You delivered a plan this summer to the president to get the Afghanistan economy back on its feet that relies in part on tapping into the country's estimated $1 trillion in mineral resources, trillion even by Washington standards, right, as you said, a lot of money. The president has said we can use some of those resources to pay, to repay us for what we've spent there. Where does the plan stand, and are we going to be able to benefit from that?
A few years ago, the U.S. Geological Survey did a survey of Afghanistan. It concluded that there was about $1 trillion of natural resources, not counting oil and gas, so copper, lithium, minerals of those sort. That's a big number. And then ultimately getting some big international mining firms to come in and do the job.
Yeah.
But what really goes on in these silent and far-fetched mountains?
We're not a new kid on the block when it comes to Afghanistan. Our first work in Afghanistan started in 1952, and we were there until about 1973. One of the things that we discovered when we started work is that there was a huge amount of mineral data available within the Ministry of Mines and Industries at that time and within the Afghan Geological Survey. This was mostly old Soviet data that went back to... We used the old Soviet data to compile the first assessment of what we call the preliminary assessment of the mineral resources of the country. That was completed in 2010. We were approached by the Department of Defense and said, and they asked us whether or not, or how could they basically increase interest in the development of these mineral resources in these boxes. And we told them, we normally do not go beyond what you see, but if you want to increase the interest, then you need to go into each one of the boxes and develop detailed information and data. We did that. This block map basically includes metallic minerals, industrial minerals, and locations for gemstones or precious stones. So it's a full look at the mineral resource assessment as we look at them in USGS. That confirmed basically that we were right in our assessment because we found what we should have found there.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
دلبستگی ها و وابستگی ها و آلودگی ها یواش یواش تو آدم میاد.
Worldly attachments and desires affects our heart and soul gradually. They enter the layers of our existence and make them dirty. A good example is a pool or pond of water in an abundant place which is full of water. If this pond or pool is not dredged, the surface of the water will look clean. However, the depths will be dirty and muddy. Our minds and souls are exactly like this. They gradually become dirty and muddy because of the sins.
کی خودشو نشون میده؟ اون لجن بالا میزنه اون موقع که یه پا بخوره این حوض.
But when does this dirtiness show itself? In case of pond or water, when it is shoveled, and in case of our souls, when it is tested with tribulations. It is on that time that the real dirt and mud show up and are seen by the eyes. Thus, we must be careful not to do bad deeds and not to make our souls dirty and impure. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Kalav Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In the United States, the white net being cast by Justice Department prosecutors as they move beyond charging 6th of January rioters could encompass scores of potential witnesses from both inside and outside of government. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer, Luke Broadwater, and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled, Justice Department Investigation of 6th of January Confronts Sprawling Cast of Characters. Among the challenges facing the federal grand jury recently empaneled to investigate the 6th of January attack on the Capitol is the sheer number of people who might have information relevant to its inquiry. According to a subpoena issued by the grand jury, prosecutors are asking for records about people who organized or spoke at several pro-Trump rallies after the election. They presumably include two events in Washington in November and December of 2020, that preceded the gathering on the Ellipse near the White House on 6th of January 2021, where President Donald J. Trump told the crowd to descend on the Capitol. The subpoena is also seeking records about anyone who provided security at those events and about those who were deemed to be VIP attendees. Moreover, it requests information about any members of the executive and legislative branches of the government who may have taken part in planning or executing the rallies, or tried to obstruct, influence, impede, or delay the certification of the presidential election. Each of these broad categories could involve dozens of individuals. Taken together, the total number of potential witnesses, or at some point targets, sought after by the grand jury could easily reach into the hundreds. The investigation appears to be in its early stages, and there is no way of knowing at this point where it may go, what crimes it might identify, or who it may ultimately focus on. Many people of interest to investigators might be called only as witnesses. One possible roadmap, at least in terms of who the grand jury may still want to hear from, is the parallel probe by the House Select Committee investigating the Capitol attack, which has already interviewed hundreds of witnesses, including on Tuesday, 5th of April, Ivanka Trump, the former president's daughter and advisor. A relatively small group of political operatives did the bulk of the work in organizing the pro-Trump rallies in Washington that kicked off after the election and sought to challenge the results, often using the slogan, Stop the Steal. Prominent among them, according to interviews and documents, was Amy Kramer, a former Tea Party activist who helped create a group called Women for America First. The group set up a cross-country bus tour gathering Mr. Trump's aggrieved supporters behind the baseless assertions of a stolen election. Within hours of the last polls closing on Election Day, Amy Kramer started working closely with her daughter, Kylie Jane Kramer, to set up one of the first Stop the Steal Facebook pages. Both women were involved, often in close coordination with the White House, in planning pro-Trump rallies on 14th of November and 12th of December 2020, and then in setting up Donald Trump's appearance at the Ellipse on 6th of January 2021. Two other people who helped Amy Kramer were Jennifer Lawrence and Dustin Stockton, both of whom had once worked closely with Steve Bannon, a former top advisor to Donald Trump. Another organizer for Women for America First was Cindy Shafian, who ultimately broke away from the group to form a new organization, the 80% Coalition, which planned its own event on 5th of January 2021. Then there was a separate group of planners around Ali Alexander, a provocateur who rose in right-wing circles after the election. Mr. Alexander, an associate of Donald Trump's longtime advisor, Roger Stone, was part of a group of activists who planned an event at the Capitol itself and marched with the crowd to the building after Donald Trump's speech at the Ellipse. Altogether, scores of people spoke at the rallies in November and December and at the gathering on 5th of January and 6th of January. They included people like Mr. Stone, Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and Alex Jones, the conspiracy theorist and host of the television show InfoWars. The speakers also included pastors, state-level politicians, and anti-vaccine activists. It is hard to know who prosecutors might consider a VIP from these events, especially for the November rally, often known as the Million MAGA March, and the one in December, which is sometimes referred to as the Jericho March. There were dozens of VIPs who attended Donald Trump's incendiary speech at the Ellipse on 6th of January 2021, according to leaked documents from event organizers. That rally also featured appearances by Rudolph Giuliani, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, and John Eastman, the law professor who was promoting the idea that Vice President Mike Pence could block congressional certification of the Electoral College results. The attendees at the Ellipse speech included Mike Lindell, the MyPillow chief executive who helped spread Donald Trump's lies about a rigged election, and the YouTube stars known as Diamond and Silk, who are prominent Donald Trump supporters. The federal grand jury subpoena examined by the New York Times seeks information about members of the executive and legislative branches of the government who might have been involved in the effort to delay congressional certification of the election results, suggesting that prosecutors are interested in learning more about the roles that Donald Trump's aides and allies inside the government may have played. It is not clear if any Trump-era executive or legislative branch members have received subpoenas, and there is no public indication that anyone has been targeted for prosecution. But in looking for more information about what was happening at both the White House and on Capitol Hill as Donald Trump sought to stay in power, the House Select Committee has already expressed interest in a range of White House and campaign advisors, as well as contractors who work to set up the rally. They exist in concentric circles in and around Donald Trump's orbit. Among them is Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff under Donald Trump, who turned over text messages to the House Select Committee that served as a roadmap not just for his own activities, but those of others. He was one of the few people with Donald Trump as the riot at the Capitol took place. Katrina Pearson, a longtime Trump political advisor, was in direct contact with Donald Trump about the details of the rallies on 5th of January and 6th of January 2021, including who would be speaking and what music will be played, according to a former administration official and a House committee. Katrina Pearson attended a meeting in which Donald Trump is said to have discussed wanting the National Guard deployed, anticipating counter-protests. Caroline Wren, a professional fundraiser and a friend of Kimberly Guilfoyle, an advisor to Donald Trump and a girlfriend of Donald Trump Jr., was listed on an attachment for a permit that rally organizers gave the Park Police. Megan Powers, a longtime Donald Trump aide, was listed on a rally permit. Among the Republicans in Congress who worked publicly to keep Donald Trump in power where Representatives Mo Brooks of Alabama, Paul Gosar of Arizona, and Andy Biggs of Arizona, all of whom Ali Alexander, the Stop the Steal organizer, has said helped set the events of 6th of January in motion. We four schemed up of putting maximum pressure on Congress while they were voting, Ali Alexander said in a since-deleted video posted online, so that who we couldn't lobby, we could change the hearts and the minds of Republicans who were in that body hearing our loud roar from outside. Paul Gosar's chief of staff has said his office merely promoted Stop the Steal events and was not involved in planning them. Mr. Biggs, who provided a video message for Ali Alexander to play at a 19th of December rally, has denied coordinating event planning with Mr. Alexander. Mo Brooks, who wore body armor on stage on 6th of January 2021 as he told the crowd to start taking down names, also denied coordinating with Mr. Alexander. Mo Brooks recently turned on Donald Trump after the former president rescinded his endorsement in a Senate race and said Donald Trump had repeatedly asked him in recent months to illegally rescind the election, remove President Biden, and force a new special election. Mr. Brooks was one of two members of Congress who spoke at Donald Trump's rally at the Ellipse before the attack on the Capitol. The other was Representative Madison Cawthorn, Republican of North Carolina, who weeks earlier encouraged the public to call members of Congress and lightly threatened them if they did not support Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud. Representative Louie Gohmert, Republican of Texas, unsuccessfully sued Mike Pence over his refusal to interfere in the election certification. Other Republicans who used inflammatory rhetoric around that time included Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia and Lauren Boebert of Colorado, first-term lawmakers who referred to the day as Republicans' 1776 moment. On 21st of December 2020, Donald Trump met with members of the House Freedom Caucus to discuss their plans to challenge Joe Biden's victory. Among those present were Paul Gosar, Mr. Biggs, Mo Brooks, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and Representatives Jim Jordan of Ohio and Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, who were deeply involved in Mr. Trump's efforts to fight the election results. The House Committee has so far asked only three members of Congress for an interview: Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the Republican leader who engaged in what he called a very heated call with Donald Trump during the riot; Jim Jordan; and Scott Perry. All three men have refused to agree to a voluntary interview.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. La 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 we are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the jurisprudential laws of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And Sheikh Javid, what if someone recites a part of the zikr? This is one of the questions, all right, I'd like to ask you. If someone recites any part of the zikr of the sajda,
yes,
before his forehead rests on the Turbah al-Dumur.
Yeah, very good.
All right? Or after he has raised his head off the Mur, right?
Yes.
Okay. What will the jurisprudential status of his prayer be?
Well, if a person intentionally utters the zikr or the recital of sajda, because every part of the prayer has a zikr, something to be recited,
mm-hmm.
whether it is ruku or sujood, or whether it's tashahud. So these are the different zikrs or the different recitals that must be recited. Now, if a person intentionally recites or utters the zikr of sajda before his forehead, you know, reaches the ground or rests on the turba,
yes,
and his body become, and before his body becomes steady, of course, because steadiness is one of the essential conditions, very mm-hmm. important condition.
Yes.
Or if he raises his head from sajda intentionally before the zikr is completed, is void, because the zikr is a part and parcel of ruku or sujood. Okay, mm-hmm. and one should not move. while reciting the zikr, let alone with you recite it before the, your head rests on the turba or before your body is steady. So it is necessary and very important to note that one's body must be steady. He should place his forehead and then start reciting the zikr. Unfortunately, we see that many people are in a hurry. They raise their hand, their heads up, and moves up to stand up for the second or for the third rak'ah before the zikr is completely. So their head is not on that on the turba while reciting.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a part of the zikr is said while the head is on the turba, on the thing which is allowable for sajda.
Yes.
But then half of the zikr is recited in the air, and that's not permissible.
Uh-huh.
And if a person
that's
is...
That's not viewed or regarded as complete sajda,
it's complete
basically.
Sajda. And if it becomes, if it happens intentionally, the prayer is white.
Mm-hmm.
But if it happens by mistake or unintentionally or forgetfully, the prayer is not made white.
Mm-hmm. Sheikh Javid, sajda should be performed on anything which is permissible and allowable, right?
Yeah.
Is it okay, is it permissible to do sajda on one's nails if nothing is found around?
Well, many people are under the impression that if you do not find anything which is allowable for sajda, then you are allowed to do sajda on the back of your hand or on the back of your palm or on your nails, which is not true, of course. Because the religious authorities have said that in the when one has access to, for example, to leaves of tree, to stones, to cement, to tiles, to wooden stuff,
yes,
and to even tissue or maybe cotton,
yes. Mm-hmm.
If you're wearing a piece of cloth made of cotton, it's you should do sajda on it rather than on the back of your hand. So it's not permissible in the existence of all of these things.
Yes.
It is not permissible to do sajda on the back of your hands, and your prayer will not be valid. You see, there are different things. The best of things on which sajda is allowed, of course, is the turba of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn, alayhi salatu wassalam.
Obviously.
And then we have any other turba made from any other soil or any other piece of earth or clay.
Or natural stuff,
natural,
right?
Stuff. Anything which is not edible, which is not mineral, and which is not, which does not come from minerals, okay?
Yes. What about the
like
leaves? Leaves of the trees?
Leaves of trees.
Yes.
Leaves of trees which are not edible for human beings, okay?
Uh-huh. Not
example,
vegetables,
yeah,
for example.
If you perform sajda on grass, which is not eaten by mankind, by human beings,
yes,
it is permissible.
Mm-hmm.
But if there is a vegetable which is eaten by both animals and human beings, it's not permissible to do sajda on it.
Okay.
So doing sajda on edibles and clothing and minerals is not allowed.
Uh-huh.
Like carpet is clothing. The thing that you wear, like for example a piece of handkerchief or anything,
yes,
these are clothing. And of course, sajda is not allowed under any circumstances on these things. Okay, in the case of taqiyya, that's something else. But we are talking,
yes,
we are talking about, for example, things
normal
which
situation
are available, normal situation.
Yes, I see.
Like, okay.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let me ask you actually for a break. We take a break here. Stay with us and don't go away. We'll be back very shortly.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Al-Ali al-Azim, Subhanallah.
back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker at the studio. And the topic we were dealing with here in this episode of the Islamic Laws was the rules and jurisprudential status of the prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, before the break, you were talking about the, in fact, allowable things that one can do the sajda on, right? Sheikh Javid, is it permissible to perform sajda on limestone or gypsum?
It is allowed to perform sajda on limestone and gypsum.
Sheikh Javid, what about the paper? Is it allowable for sajda?
Well, it is in order. It is quite valid to perform sajda on paper if it is manufactured from allowable sources, from anything which is permissible, like, for example, wood or grass. Of course, if paper is made from wood or grass, of course, it's permissible to do sajda. Mm-hmm. And also, if it's made from cotton, we do know that paper is also made from cotton. If it's made from cotton, it's permissible to do sajda on it. But if it's made from silk, then sajda will not be permissible on it.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice contribution and answers to the questions about the very important topic and the principle of the rules of prayer, in fact, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And thank you, dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. And if you have any questions and queries, you can drop your comments or whatever you think of the program at englishradio@irib.ir. And you can also search us by Googling and searching the title of the program, that is Islamic Laws, and plus English Radio. And then you can very easily find us. You can't miss us. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.